This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord. This is the part of the show where we try to put our conversation for the hour into some context, to boil down what we'll be discussing into one big theme. But frankly, today, what's the point? We're just under 3 weeks away from the midterms, and it feels sometimes like this election is about everything, all the time, all at once. Whether the nation supports or repudiates President Trump, whether the Me Too movement has affected our politics, the future of healthcare, immigration policy, our economy, national security, diversity, Brett Kavanaugh. It's an election about everything that makes us America right now. And in states like New Hampshire, those national debates blend with local concerns to make for some pretty interesting politics. So, today's show is about everything. Sorry to dump so much in your lap, but such is life. We'll get to that after you hear this.
The following message comes from our sponsor, Capital One. The CreditWise app from Capital One recently released three new features, including a Social Security number tracker, to help users quickly detect fraud for free. Here's head of CreditWise, Joe Whitchurch.
While identity fraud is intimidating and can sound really complex, a little bit of effort can go a long way in helping you understand if you've been a victim of identity fraud.
CreditWise is free for everyone, whether you're a Capital One customer or not. You can find CreditWise in your app or Play Store now.
This is Peter Sagal. When we began Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we dreamed that our rude jokes would be, in the end, the appropriate way to talk about the news. And look! It happened. Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Joining us from our home base in Washington is Juana Summers, a national politics reporter with the Associated Press. Juana, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, welcome.
Hey there.
Katie Sanders is the managing editor for the nonprofit fact-checking website PolitiFact. She joins us from the Poynter Institute, a professional school for journalists in St. Petersburg, Florida. Katie, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
And here with me at New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord is Casey McDermott, who covers politics and policy. Casey, thanks for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with New Hampshire's congressional races. The state has two districts, but both of those races are pretty interesting right now. Give us a sense of who's running.
Sure. So the congressional districts kind of split the state in half. On one side, we have the first district, which covers kind of the eastern part of the state. In that race, we have a contest between Chris Pappas, the Democrat, and Eddie Edwards, the Republican. Both of them fairly young and I think fairly mild-mannered. You know, people have described them as two of the really, you know, nice guys in their respective political parties, very non-controversial. They disagree, but often respectfully on a number of issues. On the other side of the state, we have incumbent Democratic Congresswoman Annie Custer. This is her third term in the House, and this election is largely being framed as kind of a referendum on whether or not she's been effective in that role. She's being challenged by a first-term Republican state legislator, Steve Negrin. He's a retired Air Force officer, and he also talks a lot about his family's heritage immigrating here from Mexico in the context of his kind of immigration policy.
Yeah, immigration came up during a debate that New Hampshire Public Radio hosted between Congresswoman Custer and State Rep Negrin. Here is part of their back and forth about immigration, specifically about the Trump administration's family separation policy. Listen.
The laws that we were actually enforcing were laws that had been on the books for years. So it isn't something that Republicans just started to do. And I think it's a bit disingenuous.
In terms
that,
of the separation of families.
I think it's disingenuous about being able to label it and throwing it at our feet. To do that, we have families here in the United States that get separated because of violating the law. So it really isn't any different. And when our president found out about it, he signed an executive order to try and curtail that. So I think there was some empathy from a part of this administration.
That was Republican State Rep Steve Negrin debating Congresswoman Amy Custer on New Hampshire Public Radio's program The Exchange. You can find more of their coverage online at nhpr.org. Casey, other than immigration, what are some of the other big issues that folks in New Hampshire are voting on?
Well, I think in that race, in particular, it's really being framed as, are you for the Trump administration or are you against the Trump administration? Incumbent Congresswoman Custer has very much tried to tie her Republican challenger to the Trump administration, and he also will embrace Trump's policies almost wholeheartedly, with very few exceptions, and also is tied very closely with a number of Trump supporters, both locally and nationally. He has a campaign event coming up with former Trump advisor Corey Lewandowski. He's been endorsed by a number of Trump supporters. The people running his campaign were top advisors on the Trump campaign. So you'll hear him try to very emphatically say, if you send me to Washington, I will be a supporter for President Trump and his policies. And Congressman Custer, on the other hand, saying, you need to keep me in office in order to keep a check on this administration.
Domenico Montanaro, let me come to you. How does what we're seeing in New Hampshire compare to how these kinds of races are playing out in the rest of the U.S.?
Well, these were two House races that were pretty close in 2016, and they moved away from Democrats and toward President Trump. Now, that is reflective of what happened in 2016, but it's also reflective of the fact that in this midterm, neither of those two races is considered a toss-up race or even a lean race. At this point, the first congressional district race, which is the eastern part of the state, includes Manchester and Portsmouth, is the race that looks like it could be closest, but even that is rated as a likely Democratic seat. And that's reflective of what's happening in a broader sense in this midterm.
Juana Summers, what about the way that Democrats are talking about Republicans and vice versa? It seems that there's this mix in various races between whether candidates are focusing on one's ties to or opposition of President Trump, or whether they're focusing on more local issues. How are you hearing it?
Sure, Joshua. We've seen this in a number of competitive races across the country where Democrats are focusing really hard on highlighting their Republican opponent's ties to President Donald Trump, making this election, in many senses, most midterm elections are indeed referendums on the incumbent president, but Democrats are really pushing to enhance those things, to make them more obvious for voters as they're looking to win over some of those must-win independents. Whereas Republicans, I'm noticing across the map, and I think this is true in many ways in New Hampshire too, they're talking about what they've done for their local community, local wins, local issues, and really trying to keep their distance from the president in many cases, especially in these districts that maybe Hillary Clinton won in 2016 or where it was very tight between Clinton and President Trump.
Katie Sanders, are there any of these narratives, particularly in the pro-Trump, anti-Trump comparisons, tying a candidate to President Trump, distancing oneself from President Trump, that need some fact-checking? How truthful have some of these narratives been?
We're seeing a lot of untruthful narratives. I think one of them that you just played, actually, my fact-checker Spidey Sense was going off because the Republican was saying that this has been going on for a long time. We just didn't talk about it. And that's, in fact, false. That's borrowed from Trump's own rhetoric because the policy was really begun by his administration. Families were rarely prosecuted under previous administrations. But moreover, we're seeing, I'll stay on immigration, we're seeing a lot of Republicans going pretty aggressively on Democrats who have weighed in on whether immigration and customs enforcement, ICE, should be kind of dialed back. We're seeing that in Florida and Arizona, Republicans really hitting the Democrats for really, even if they haven't said they firmly want to abolish ICE, kind of hitting them for saying that they want to do it. And that might not always be true. So my general rule is just about everything needs context, at least.
My comic book nerd was so happy to hear you refer to your spider sense. I think you made my morning. You completely made my morning. Katie Sanders, managing editor of PolitiFact, is with us, alongside NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro, Juana Summers, national political reporter for the AP, and New Hampshire Public Radio politics and policy reporter, Casey McDermott. Glad to hear from some of you about the big issues that have got your attention for the midterms. Jordan is in Auburn, New Hampshire. Jordan writes, I am absolutely voting as a New Hampshire resident. Social and economic policy matters a lot. But my biggest fear, and what I really want my vote to do, is save the planet from its literal ecological destruction. Climate change and other eco matters will hurt us more than people think. Laura tweeted, my biggest concern about the midterm elections is to reestablish some sort of balance of power. Nobody wins when only one side is represented. I would like to say I'm voting for bipartisan candidates, but there aren't very many out there. And Chris wrote on our Facebook page, I've already voted, as early voting started today in North Carolina. Poll workers revealed to me that they're happy we're having many early voting days, as they would never be able to accommodate everyone voting on the same day, November 6th. Casey, give us a sense of what New Hampshire is like politically for those who've never been here. In what ways does it reflect other parts of the country, and in what ways is New Hampshire really unique?
I think New Hampshire is really a true purple state. We sent an all-Democratic and all-female delegation to Congress, which I believe was a first for the state. But Republicans control every branch of government at the state level. Some of that can be chalked up to gerrymandering, but I think it also just reflects the kind of voting patterns that exist and the true, you know, kind of live-free-or-die independence that a lot of New Hampshire residents like to think that they have. In fact, independents are the largest voting bloc in the state. They make up about 40% of registered voters as of the latest tally. So that can contribute to some unpredictability in election results, and also can contribute to candidates who often are perhaps less extreme, as you might see in other places, toward one end of the political spectrum or the other.
I know we got to let you go in a moment, but Casey, what does the polling look like right now for the congressional races?
So there's not a ton of polling here, so we have very little to go on. But as Domenico said, both congressional races are looking like they are leaning toward the Democrats right now. That said, obviously a lot can change between now and Election Day. So it you know, for that reason, and also for the reason that I outlined, given the political makeup of the state, it could be, you know, could turn out differently.
What does it seem like is going to make the difference, these national issues or more local issues?
I think local issues. I think New Hampshire is really a state where people are very plugged in politically to what's going on at the state house, what's going on at their local town government. A lot of the candidates, while they will reference what's happening in the national landscape, and I think are increasingly doing that in New Hampshire, at the end of the day, people are really voting about what's going on in their backyards.
So firing people up about, say, Nancy Pelosi or Donald Trump isn't 100% effective.
Correct. And I think people are concerned with, you know, issues like the opioid crisis, issues like health care, issues like the economy, taxes. New Hampshire has a unique tax structure here, so that, you know, can be very influential in people's voting patterns as well.
Casey McDermott covers politics and policy for New Hampshire Public Radio. Casey, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Domenico, I wonder if we could pick up with that last question I asked Casey. Kendra tweeted, "What I would like to see is all of the Democrats and Republicans voted out of Congress. They are so polarized, we need to start over." How much do you get a sense that the pure polarization of today's politics is just changing the way voters approach this year's midterms? I mean, you know, Nancy Pelosi's name still comes up quite a bit on the campaign trail. She's an obvious kind of a hot button for many Republican voters. But is that working in terms of making people show up, or is it just turning people off?
You know, a lot of people might be and are frustrated with politics in the country, but we're seeing the opposite effect of not keeping people home or voting for some third-party coalition. In fact, it's people strapping on the T-shirts and going as hard as they can in their political corners. I mean, the fact is midterms are usually about activists. They're usually about the hardest core people within the party. But in fact, we're seeing the potential for a surge this year in turnout. I spoke to Michael McDonald, who's a professor at the University of Florida, who's really one of the preeminent turnout experts in the country, maintains a turnout database. He expects there to be a turnout of about 45% to 50% of eligible voters this year. That doesn't sound like a lot, but it would be the highest level for a midterm since the mid-1960s. And that is really spurred on by all of this high interest we're seeing, high turnout in primaries and in special elections. And, you know, frankly, you've seen Democrats really fired up to vote against this president. And we've seen that, according to Pew, 60% of people say the president is a factor in their vote, and that's higher than it's ever been.
I wonder, Juana Summers, what your take is on that in terms of the potential playbook for Democrats. First of all, let's just set a little context. Let's focus on the House, for example. How many seats would the Democrats need to flip the House?
Sure. So Democrats would need 23 seats in order to take control of the House of Representatives. And right now, most public polling, when we look across the landscape, suggests that they're making good efforts and things are looking good for them right now. One thing that I've noticed as I've been talking to folks who work on the Democratic side of the aisle, who are professional political folks, is they're spending a lot of money to make sure that their voters turn out. And they're particularly looking at the types of voters, infrequent voters, who say may show up in a presidential election year, but are more likely to stay home in an off year or a midterm year. And there's a reason for that. Typically, when we look at the electorate that shows up for midterm elections, it's typically older, whiter, and more Republican tilting. So you see Democrats spending a lot of money and a lot of time on the ground trying to turn out younger voters, those millennials, voters of color, Latinos, African Americans, and Asians, who are more likely to vote for Democrats but are also more likely to stay home in midterm years.
Is there a certain benchmark, Juana, for what Democrats would consider, for lack of a better word, a blowout? Like, is the goal just to get 50% plus one, or is there a larger, like a stretch goal that the Democratic Party is aiming for?
What I'm hearing from most people, including Ben Ray Lujan, the congressman who chairs the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, is they don't think this is going to be a blowout year. They feel confident in their chances of taking back the House, of turning the House blue. But I don't think most people, most members of Congress who are involved in this, would say that there's going to be a huge blue wave crashing over, a pickup of some 10 seats or something like that. They're focused on delivering that 23 of turning the House blue. And the message I keep hearing from them is they want to do that as a balance of power. Right now, Republicans control every branch of government, and they want to restore a balance of power to this administration.
Yeah, this idea of a blue wave was the focus of an email from Marty, who wrote, "I'm all about the blue wave, but I'm afraid that between voter disenfranchisement, lingering gerrymandering, and possible foreign interference, we are about to be punked again." Domenico, let me ask you about some of the polling. What are some of the main trends in national polls right now in terms of how the Democrats and the Republicans might do?
Well, when we look at our NPR PBS NewsHour Marist polling, Democrats have had an advantage on what's known as the congressional ballot. Who would you prefer to be to run Congress, the Democrat in your district or the Republican in your district? You know, we've had an advantage for Democrats anywhere from 7 to 12 points over from the summer until now. Other public polling has shown it to be double digits. That's about the range that Democrats feel like they would be able to take at least those 23 seats in the House. And I look at some other factors, too. Just look at the landscape and the playing field. When I gamed out how many seats would be up for grabs this year, I found that there were 80 seats that were competitive to potentially competitive. Despite all the talk of Kavanaugh, you know, that confirmation battle enthusing Republicans, and it certainly did, only six of those seats are Democratic-held seats. 74 seats of the potentially competitive to competitive landscape are held by Republicans. No matter what, you look at that, and, you know, if Democrats win half of those, that's the House.
Glad to hear from some of you with regards to your concerns about the midterms, including about the nature of polling in general. Domenico, I'd love you to respond to this comment from a listener who left a note in our inbox.
I'm Alan from Asheville, North Carolina, and I'm frustrated with the elections with not having enough polls in down ballot races, even U.S. House, but state House and stuff, because if it's a close election, I want to vote Democrat, at least at the federal and state level. But if it's a shoo-in, then I want to vote third party, Green or Libertarian, or write my own name in. So I need to know if the race is close or not, if it's a shoo-in, if my vote might be the deciding vote. And I need a poll. I need some polls to decide that. And it actually changes my vote. The polls change my vote.
Alan, thanks for your comment. Domenico?
That cracks me up. If he wants to run for office, he should run for office. If he wants to vote third party because that's his conscience, then he should do so. I get a pragmatic approach, though. And I think a lot of, you know, establishment Democrats would argue that they wish there were a lot more voters like him who voted in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania for the Democrat instead of voting for the third party candidate. Now, when it comes to polls, look, there is a huge problem in this country when it comes to polling generally. And then when you go and drill down into the state level or district level or state house level, my goodness, the response rate that people are getting from polling is lower and lower and lower every year. In other words, you make a phone call. Does somebody wish to participate in that? That just continues to decrease. It takes a lot of money to conduct a good poll and to get a sizable enough sample that the results are representative. And it's really tough. And I would just say, go based on the issues and vote your conscience.
Yeah, quite a lot of you expressed real concern with the very nature of polling. Peter wrote on our Facebook page, "Please discuss the obsession the media, NPR included, has with the horse race method of election coverage. Is it irresponsible journalism to report on polls when such reporting could affect turnout? Our elections are not sporting events." And yeah. Michael wrote on our Facebook page, "You nitwits still trust polls? Remember how that turned out in 2016.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, look, I mean, this is a tried and true criticism. You know, we can get into the science of polling and whatnot. And I would disagree that we're obsessed, quote unquote, with polling. We do use it to pepper our coverage and to give us a sense of what the snapshots are within districts. In fact, I'm far more interested in trends in polls rather than poll to poll horse race. I think that's not a good way to look at the polling. I think that, again, overall trends and, you know, issues and questions of giving you a sense of a kind of a temperature read of people is way more useful.
I should note, earlier this year, back in February, we did a whole hour on the nature of political polling. Domenico was part of the panel. You can listen to that program, which we called Can We Trust Polls? On our website. Just search for it online at the1a.org. That's the word the number one, the letter a.org. Juana, I also kind of feel like the comment we heard from Alan is exactly what many Democratic operatives are afraid of, that Democrats will be like, it's a shoo-in. I don't need to go vote, as opposed to saying, no, I'm going to vote because my vote matters. Alan sounds exactly like the kind of voter, and God bless him, but exactly like the kind of voter that makes many Democratic operatives tear their hair out.
That is absolutely right. When I've spoken to Democratic operatives and those in Democratic and progressive-leaning outside groups, they're worried exactly about voters like Alan. While they see their chances are good of taking back the House, they've really been focusing on a message of social responsibility. In particular, I'm thinking of a conversation I had with folks over at the NAACP who said that they're tailoring their message to make sure that voting is a responsibility that becomes a pattern for their voters so that they show up again and again and again, because there are elections every year and they're trying to set the sense that, yes, while maybe Democrats stand a good chance of taking back the House in 2018, there's an election almost every year coming up now, and this is really the ground game they're setting ahead for 2020 so that those voters will show up, it will become a habit, and it will become a thing that they do again and again.
Katie Sanders, I wonder what you're seeing in terms of political advertising and messaging during this election cycle. It's been interesting as we've been traveling the country to look at the difference between ads here in New Hampshire versus the ads we saw on TV in Michigan earlier this year versus the ones we saw in the Seattle area. But are there any trends in terms of what the messaging looks like or sounds like?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we're monitoring more races on the Senate and House level than ever before. And it's interesting that you say they all sound different state to state, because we've heard a lot of trends coming through. One of those is absolutely health care. And going deeper into it, we hear Republicans attacking Democrats for their positions on Medicare, actually. There are more Democrats who are supportive of expanding Medicare, making that available for everyone, and Republicans, including Donald Trump, are saying that this stands to jeopardize the program, you know, quote, as we know it. On the flip side, you have Democrats who are really going after Republicans for their votes on the health care law that's currently in place. Specifically, you see a lot of numbers in mailers and TV ads across these states, particularly on pre-existing condition protections. Democrats are really tailoring the estimates of people who would be affected by the Republican laws that failed last year that would have weakened pre-existing condition protection by saying so-and-so amount will Mainers or Minnesotans will, you know, had their protections jeopardized. So I would say those are the biggest themes. It's healthcare again and again.
Katie, I'd love to get your reaction to a listener in the Midwest and a note that they left in our inbox.
This is Mike in Fishers, Indiana. I'd like the panel to discuss fact-checking in candidate advertising. It seems that ads stretch the truth and sometimes don't contain any truth whatsoever. So I'd like the panel's opinion about fact-checking. I understand newspapers aren't necessarily resourced to do this on a regular basis.
Mike, thanks for that comment. Katie?
Yeah, I think he's right that the candidates, the interest groups, are very tempted to stretch the truth. That doesn't mean every campaign advertisement that you see is false or ridiculous, which we call pants on fire. But you do see they kind of succumb to that temptation to lay it on extra thick and maybe blur the lines quite a bit. So, sure, we see lots of TV ads going after candidates' personal lives or, you know, that most embarrassing episode, pulling it over the line, maybe blurring what actually happened. Like he said, newspapers and TV stations, radio stations aren't always equipped to do that kind of fact-checking day in, day out themselves. But, you know, I think that fact-checking has grown in popularity. We've grown over our 10 years of being in business at PolitiFact. And I think you see more of a willingness to do this within stories about the ads themselves. But certainly, that's what we do every day. We think it's really important.
I would say that it's a good reason to support your local paper, because sometimes when a political ad goes way too far, it turns into news on the campaign trail, and then whoever your local political reporter is will follow up on that. So just one more reason to support local media like public radio stations and newspapers. But Domenico, we should also be honest. I mean, there is a lot of money in political ads. Television stations rake in significant revenue every 2 years, and that's a revenue stream that they probably don't want to give up.
No. There's a lot of brand new, shiny, what they call microwave trucks in a lot of places in Columbus, Ohio, and Las Vegas this year, Raleigh, North Carolina. Lots of places where, you know, they're kind of smaller markets, and a lot of the money can go in to those stations. You know, the nice thing is we are able to see how much money is spent in a lot of those places because it all has to be public. And, you know, sometimes those stations have, you know, controversies with the campaigns because some ads, if they go so far over the line, they are supposed to reject them.
Right. Juana, I wonder what you see in terms of the tone of some of these ads this time around, particularly compared to 2016. Understanding, of course, that with 2016, we had two very different kinds of advertising ground games. You had Hillary Clinton, who did a lot more conventional advertising. Donald Trump did a lot of online advertising, kind of burned up Facebook. But how do you see the difference between 2016 and 2018 ad-wise?
Sure. So I think the biggest thing, to go back to what one of the earlier callers talked about that I've heard and seen differently, is how the campaigns are approaching this issue of healthcare. I think that several years ago, you could have never imagined that Democrats would be running ads touting their support for the Affordable Care Act. But the landscape is so different now. You know, over four election cycles, you saw the Republicans accuse Democrats of messing up voters' health care with so-called Obamacare. They vowed to repeal it. They've tried. They failed. And it's given Democrats an issue to really pounce on. I think that we've also seen, in terms of advertising, a lot of these ads have gotten, frankly, and not just on TV, but also in some of the mailers that we've seen, really personal and really jarring. And I think there was some of that in 2016, but I think it's gotten a lot more that way in 2018.
And if I can give you one statistic, the Wesleyan Media Group, which citing Kantar Media, which tracks a lot of these ads and buys a lot of these ads, half of all the ads that were run in the month of September were healthcare related ads. And most of those were pro-democratic. And as Juana notes, that is a huge shift from 2010 and an ironic twist, given that Republicans took back the House, fueled by opposition to the Affordable Care Act.
I want to make sure I'm clear on what the statistic was. Half of all the political ads nationwide ran last month were all on health care.
That's right. And most of those were pro-democratic.
I know we got to pause in a minute, but it's amazing how surprising and not surprising that is. I mean, if you look at even Google's figures for what people have been searching the most in the run-up to the election, healthcare has solidly been the number one search for months.
Yeah, and I would say one other thing about some of these issues in the polls, because Pew recently looked at some of the issues and how far apart people are on them. They looked at opioid addiction, which I know was mentioned in our New Hampshire segment, the deficit, and healthcare as three of the – and ethics, by the way, as the four very big problems facing the country. And all of those are places where Republicans are on their back foot.
Liberty emails, you can't ignore all the voter suppression going on. In Georgia, a whole group of black seniors were kicked off the bus that was to take them to vote. We'll talk about voter turnout and voter suppression in just a moment. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and ponderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Let's get to some of your comments about the midterms. Lori emailed, I am a lifelong Democrat, and I can tell you what frustrates me and has for years, the complete inability of the Dems to get a message and stick to it. I've gone to my local Democrat Party website, and the front page does not say what they are for, does not tell me what they care about. Juana Summers, you've been following the Democrats in the run-up to the midterms. How common is Lori's complaint, and how well are Democrats doing at answering it?
Well, I think what Lori's pointing to is actually really common, and I think Democrats are trying to figure out how to fix it. In a number of the conversations I had, I've recently wrote an article that looks at how Democrats are trying to make sure they have record midterm turnout. They said that when they're talking to voters or they're sending out mailers or going and knocking to people's doors in these battleground states and districts, they're trying to make sure that they're telling their voters that they have a message that they are running on, rather than just having these conversations that are about just running against President Trump. They said, I was talking to some groups that did some field testing recently among Latino voters, and they said when they did this field testing, they were saying people were turned off. They said if they got a mailer from their local Democratic candidate that had President Trump's face on it, they'd be super turned off, right? They'd throw that away. They wouldn't even engage or see who the candidate was. So I think they're really trying to tweak that message and talk about what they can do for them, what's at stake. That's why you hear Democrats nationally talking about how this is the most important election of our lifetimes, why you hear that healthcare message, I think, as Domenico noted, being such a huge share of the advertising that you're seeing from pro-democratic groups, is because they do realize that they need a message for their voters to coalesce around. Otherwise, they're not going to turn out.
Domenico, I wonder if we could follow up on that theme with one more voicemail from a listener on the East Coast. Here's what John left in our inbox.
This is John Reyes in Syracuse, New York. So often on the shows, people say, the Republicans, the Democrats, the Republicans, the Democrats, the Republicans. And instead of doing that, they should be focusing on specific policies, namely the Democrats that stand for such and such, the Republicans that stand for such and such. It helps educate listeners because you don't gain anything by just going Democrats, Republicans, Democrats, Republicans.
John, thanks very much for calling in and sharing your thoughts with us. Now, Domenico, for me, I don't know how you hear this, but for me as a journalist, I feel uncomfortable saying the Democrats who stand for X. I feel more comfortable saying the Democrats who say they stand for X, or the Democrats who have done X. To me, journalistically, that's more reliable. But I do take John's point that it just feels a little bit too broad brush.
Yeah, I mean, we have to always be aware of trying to get into some of the issues and where the parties stand on these things and what they've been pushing. I think that that's been part of the pushback and why you've seen so much interest from Democrats, obviously, in this election, because they've seen so much of what President Obama did, regulations that were put in place that have been rolled back, for example, by the Environmental Protection Agency, and a whole host of other things, including an immigration policy that Democrats are firmly against. And it's also what you saw as a rise of the Tea Party in 2010, where they didn't trust a lot of their government officials, including a lot of Republicans, and how they essentially took over the Republican Party with that message of taxed enough already and being really in opposition to President Obama's Health Care Act. So the parties stand for very, very different things, and we're seeing that play out and going to come to a head in this midterm.
Katie, I wonder if you can respond to a listener who left a note on our website, the1a.org. The listener writes, with the upcoming midterm elections and Michelle Obama's advice to go high when opponents go low, what is the effectiveness of negative campaigns? Are the negative campaign ads coming from a particular party or group, Katie?
I think everyone's guilty. I don't think any party is really going high all the time, right? And I think that's because it's effective and it really sticks with people. As much as people like to say that they dislike negative advertising, and I think actually do, it is memorable, and it certainly builds that impression that people are going to remember, and that's why we see so much of it, and that's why we have jobs here as fact checkers. There's plenty to do.
You will never be unemployed, not ever. Domenico, let's touch on some of the diversity of the candidates this time around. Quite a few record numbers of women running, record numbers of LGBTQ candidates running, some of whom spoke to Ari Shapiro on All Things Considered earlier. Give us a sense of what that means for the midterms and whether many of these candidates are considered to stand a strong chance of winning.
Well, look, you're correct that there are a lot of people who are of diverse backgrounds. I mean, women are the biggest block of this that are really driving the midterms. You think of a lot of Native American candidates, you know, just in New Hampshire there, Chris Pappas, who is an openly gay man. He would be the first gay representative from the state of New Hampshire if he wins in the first congressional district there in New Hampshire as a Democrat. Now, but when, again, we look at the power of the midterms, women, they have been fired up since the day President Trump was elected. And when we talk about women, we're talking about Democratic women. There have been 235 women who have been nominated for Congress for their party's nomination. 183 of those, 183 have been Democratic women. Just if you were to take the number of Democratic women who are running, that would be bigger than the record previously of all women combined who were nominees, and that was 167. So
basically, I'm sorry, you just to clarify the numbers, you're basically saying that 3 out of 4 women in this go-round are Democratic women who've been nominated.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. And the wave of Democratic women, the year of the woman, quote-unquote, round two, after 1992, after the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings, have been driven by Democratic women. And we've seen them be very fired up in poll after poll, and you know, they are going to lead the march to the polls for Democrats. And if they win the House, it's going to be largely because of women.
Juana, there are some races where, you know, women are making a very historic historic showing. I mean, the Arizona Senate race that's going on right now between Kirsten Sinema, the Democrat, and Martha McSally, the Republican. You know, Arizona is going to have a female senator in that seat. I wonder how much you see this as a bipartisan trend. We heard the numbers from Domenico, but do we get the sense that both parties, both major parties, are trying to be part of this trend, trying to embrace this trend?
Sure. So I think that the energy when we talk about female candidates is certainly more on the side of Democrats than Republicans. And I think that's frustrated a number of Republican women. I spoke to two women who founded the group Republican Women for Progress recently, and they told me that they were really concerned that their party doesn't have an apparatus to cultivate young, promising Republican conservative women from the local, those local level seats all the way up. So nothing that really reflects, say, what you see on the left, on the Democratic side, from Emily's List, the group that cultivates and backs pro-abortion rights women, female candidates. So there's some concern certainly among Republicans. And my colleagues at AP actually asked Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell about that. The question came in this back and forth about the Senate Judiciary Committee and the lack of Republican women on that panel during the hearings around Dr. Blasey Ford and Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And these women were really, and why there were no women there. And Mitch McConnell said, you know, that's something he doesn't like. It's something he wants to see more of. But I still haven't heard Republicans forthrightly, at least to me, answer if this is such a problem, if you want to see more women in the Senate on your side, if you want to see more women moving up in the House. And we should note that there is a woman in Republican leadership in Kathy McMorris Rodgers. But where do those women come from? Because as we know, running for office is very expensive. It's very tough. It's very tactical. If you don't have help and you don't have an apparatus, those people are never going to show up.
Speaking of women in Republican leadership, Domenico, I'm not sure if you've seen anybody running or campaigning talking about Senator Susan Collins of Maine and her decision to allow the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation to move forward. That long explication she gave on the Senate floor that made a lot of people rather upset with her final decision. I haven't personally seen that be made into any kind of political hay for Democratic candidates, but have you?
Well, she's lucky she's not up for re-election.
Yeah.
If she were, she would certainly have a lot of pressure on her back. There, in the same way that a lot of these Democrats in red states that President Trump won have had to weigh and measure their vote for Brett Kavanaugh. I mean, you know, it's no surprise that Joe Manchin, minutes after Susan Collins said she was going to vote for Brett Kavanaugh, he released a statement saying that he would vote for Brett Kavanaugh. Now, yeah, it would have been a whole lot different if Susan Collins had come out and said she was going to be against Brett Kavanaugh. What would Joe Manchin do then?
Ginny from Indiana emailed, "My concern is voter suppression. I'm terrified that the votes will not be counted correctly. It is frightening what is happening in North Dakota and Georgia. What can be done to stop this?" We heard from quite a few of you about voter suppression, including one of our listeners in North Carolina who left a note through our app 1A Vox Pop.
This is Desiree from Charlotte. My biggest concern is that people will not understand or recognize how important their vote is for this election and how that can have ramifications on the elimination of names from voter logs. how can we be a country that champions and promotes democracy when we don't make it easy for all citizens to vote, not just for what benefits a certain party?
Desiree, thanks very much for sharing your thoughts with us. Juana, what concerns are we seeing about voter disenfranchisement right now?
We're seeing quite a few, actually, and Georgia is really ground zero. Stacey Abrams, who's the Democrat running for governor there, has said that her Republican rival, Brian Kemp, who's the Secretary of State, is effectively suppressing female and minority voters in that role because his office has held up more than 50,000 new voter registration applications and questioning their legality. Now, at AP, we've done an analysis of those, and we found that 70% of those pending applications are from Black Georgians. Now, Abrams has said that her path to winning the governor's mansion, it requires sporadic voters, younger and non-white voters, to show up. So she feels that this is something that could be pivotal in her campaign. Joshua, you also mentioned North Dakota, and there a federal court has refused to stay the state law that requires voters to display ID cards with their addresses. And while that may seem routine for a lot of people, it also really targets Native Americans, and that culture in many ways discourages having fixed addresses. This is a longstanding concern. It's not just Georgia and North Dakota. We've seen a lot of concerns about voter suppression across the country there. I do, though, want to point out that in recent years, a number of states have moved in ways where their laws are now making it easier to vote. There are 13 states that have approved automatic voter registration laws. Four of those have happened this year. For example, Utah voters will be able to register on Election Day in November for the first time. And in Washington State, 16 and 17-year-olds can now pre-register. So there are certainly reasons to be concerned in some of these states. But I do want to point out that in a number of states, there has been progress to make something that should be a fundamental right and something easy for people to do even easier.
Let's get to a few more quick questions before our time is up. Questions and comments. Rob tweeted, "I'm in a very Republican district, Virginia's 5th district. I just don't understand why the Democrats keep putting up extremely left-wing candidates if they want to win." Jerry tweeted, "How will immigration play in the midterms? Democrats seem silent. Republicans are falling in line with the current administration. Is it a losing issue for both sides?" Domenico, how do you see it?
Immigration is one of those issues that obviously fires up Republicans in the Republican base in a way that almost no other issue has over the past decade or so. So it depends on how it's framed. Frankly, if Republicans are going to defend a family separation policy, that's wildly unpopular. If Democrats are going to counter that by saying that they want to abolish ICE, well, that's wildly unpopular. So somehow the two groups have to be able to message it appropriately and figure out what is going to win over the most voters. I would also say to the prior caller who said that the Virginia 5th congressional race is not a competitive one and very Republican, it's actually just a lean Republican district right now, as rated by the Cook Political Report. And that's because that district is actually, you have a lot of liberal voters and you have a lot of conservative voters. There aren't a lot in between. And that's why you wind up with very conservative Republican nominees and a lot of very liberal Democratic nominees.
Katie Sanders, I wonder for folks who are looking at some of the political rhetoric and ads that are out there right now who aren't sure exactly what to believe, what would you advise voters to do as we get closer to Election Day to kind of be their own fact checkers? What would you suggest?
Sure. I would encourage them to squint as closely as they can at the television and look for that fine print. Just because an ad has fine print doesn't mean it actually checks out. But for us fact checkers, it gives us a starting point for beginning to unpack the truth of what they're really talking about. Sound bites never tell the full story. So I think you have to really think of yourself as being open-minded and go after that additional information. If that sounds like too much work, and I totally understand, you can always just support fact-checking. We have a Truth Squad membership program. I'd encourage people to do that. But certainly always keep in mind when you're seeing these ads or these scary mailers that there's more information to be had here.
Before we wrap up, I'd love to hear from Juana and Domenico what races you're watching most closely, particularly races you think might be bellwethers for the country that might tell us something significant. Juana, which races are you watching the most closely?
So one of the races that I'm watching really closely is right here in right outside of Washington and Virginia's 10th congressional district. It's the race between Barbara Comstock, the incumbent Republican, and she's got a challenger in State Senator Jennifer Wexton. And the reason why I'm so interested in that race is that I really feel that the road for control of the House of Representatives is going to run through districts where there are a lot of suburban women voters. This is a district that has been under Republican control for three decades, but in recent years, it's grown more diverse with college-educated young people, Latinos and Asians moving there, which has changed the makeup and made Democrats really see it in reach for the first time in years. It's a district Hillary Clinton won by 10 points in 2016. And in the gubernatorial contest, the Democrat Ralph Northam beat Ed Gillespie by 12 points. It's been a very expensive race so far. Right now, the last five or so polls show Jennifer Wexton ahead, but Barbara Comstock has really been trying to make that local focus that we talked about earlier, talking about all the things she's done for the district.
And Domenico, before we go, what are you watching?
You know, I'd say I'll stay on that area because Virginia actually is an early poll close time state. So if we look at another state that's an early poll close time state, that might tell us something about how the rest of the night will go. I'm looking at Kentucky and the 6th Congressional District in Kentucky. You have Amy McGrath, a former fighter pilot who's running against Andy Barr, the Republican incumbent. If a Democrat can hold up and win as a challenger in Kentucky, the rest of the night is going to be a big night for Democrats.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro, Juana Summers of the Associated Press, Katie Sanders of PolitiFact, thank you all for being with us. Today's show was produced by Paige Osborne. To learn more about her and the rest of our staff, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. See you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.